I'd like to officially welcome everyone to today's CLUIN seminar. My name is Jean Balance. I'm coming to you from the EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division, where I'll be serving as one of the co-moderators. Today's seminar has been sponsored by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers as part of their Military Munition Support Services Seminar Series. Today's seminar will look specifically at non-circle regulatory framework. While we're getting ready and allowing our latecomers just a few more moments to hop on the line, I'm going to cover some important housekeeping and reminder items before we begin the technical portion for today's broadcast. If this is your first seminar with us on CLUIN, you should have received a registration and confirmation email that had a complete set of instructions on how to join us for today's broadcast. That email would have referenced you to something called the seminar homepage, which has a complete description of the event, links to download copies of the presentation material in a PDF format that will appear at the top and near the bottom. There are options to submit feedback, collection of related resources, but most importantly, a button at the upper left corner that says Go to Seminar. If you click that button, you'll be asked to identify yourself and check in online, and then join us for the live interactive broadcast that will be delivered through a new tool, Adobe Connect. You'll be able to watch in real time as our presenters move through their presentation materials and deliver their talks. Although we have made a portion of the presentations in terms of a PDF copy of the slide decks available to download in advance, we try to encourage everyone to join us for the live interactive broadcast through Adobe. If you have any technical problems with that interactive broadcast, please feel free to report it using the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen, and we'll work to troubleshoot any issues you might be having. When you've joined us in the online Adobe Connect room, you should see a series of windows. The majority of your screen will be occupied by a window showing the slides. And again, as I've already started, our presenters will be controlling and moving you through the materials. The entire audio session will be broadcast online through Adobe Connect, so you can actually listen to the seminar right through your computer or mobile device. If you have any problems with that audio, please check your
Dwayne, I just lost audio.
Gene, I think we just lost audio.
Joined us on the phone lines. I can hear you. So if you're one of my presenters, I would ask that you remain muted until it's your turn to talk. Thank you very much. If you're on the telephone lines, all attendees have been globally muted out, and we ask that you remain on that global mute to help cut down on background noises. You'll be using the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen to report questions and comments at any time. This entire session is being broadcast and will be recorded. Within 1 to 2 weeks, you should automatically receive an email as soon as the free recording is available for free replay. And if you like what you see, we encourage you to take a look at the nearly 500 recorded seminars that we have up on the CLUIN website. So again, the majority of your screen is going to be occupied by a window showing the live PowerPoint presentation. If the slides look too small, there's a full screen button that appears in the upper left or right corner of that window. You can click it once to expand the size of the slides, and if you'd like to shrink them back down to normal size, simply press the full screen button again to turn it off. To the right of that window, you'll see a series of boxes stacked vertically. In the upper right corner, there'll be the logo for the United States Army Corps of Engineers, indicating that they're sponsoring today's session. Just below that is a collection of related websites. You can click on any one of those websites, press the Browse To button, and they'll open up locally on your own computer. And I encourage you to browse through some of those resources as we go through today's broadcast. And then just below that is the important Q&A window, which already has a welcome message from me, Jean Ballant. You can privately type up your comments, questions, or report technical difficulties at any time here, and then simply press the little cartoon bubble or hit enter, and that'll submit it over to our Q&A window so that we can work with you to help address the question or resolve any issues. With that, I think that's the end.
Jean, I think that we may have lost audio again.
Do I still have Dwayne Ford on the line?
Yes, Jane. I think we're periodically losing audio.
We're going to work to resolve that. If that happens one more time, I can clear out the lines. Their speakers will remain on, but I can take care of that. So please feel free to go ahead with introductions.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Jane. Well, just wanted to say good afternoon to friends, neighbors, colleagues, and welcome to the fourth episode in our Military Munition Support Services mini-series. Gene's already reviewed the instructions in the administrative announcement, so I guess I reckon I can skip most of that, and we'll go ahead and launch this ship. Again, many thanks to EPA's Clewin staff, especially Gene Ballant, for their assistance and support in conducting our webinar today. And even a bigger thanks to our viewing audience for making time in your busy schedules to join us for the session today. You know, the theme for this month's webinar is the non-circular regulatory framework. You know, most of the DoD munitions work is conducted under the circular tent, but we thought it was important to set aside some M2S2 time to present material from projects which are outside of CERCLA. And hopefully, you know, unlike Homer Simpson, there's still some room in our brains and we can absorb some non-CERCLA information without having to jettison our CERCLA knowledge. You know, in a departure from our earlier M2S2 webinars, today's session is only a couple hours long instead of all afternoon. But as they say, you know, good things come in small packages, and we think that we've got some excellent speakers and material lined up. Ed Babe is an environmental regulatory specialist with EMCX, and Ed was the point man for assembling today's webinar, so many thanks to Ed. And I'm Dwayne Ford. I'll be facilitating today's session, introducing the speakers, trying to keep us on time. Just here's the agenda of what we're going to cover today. Let's see, Gene's already covered these administrative things, but I did want to once again mention the last item, the last bullet. So far, we've had very, very good attendance on these N2S2 webinars. We like to interpret that as meaning that our audience views the webinars as being a good value. If that is indeed the case, please become part of our marketing department and let your colleagues, customers, regulators, friends, family, so on, know about the webinars. There isn't any pay associated with becoming a marketeer, but we would certainly appreciate it. And, you know, as they say on trailers for like The Walking Dead or Game of Thrones, only one episode remaining before the season finale. Well, you know, here's what we got coming up. And if you haven't already registered, I want to know why. And again, you know, if you know someone who might be interested in one or both of these topics, please make sure to make them aware of the opportunity. The previous M2S2 webinars, those were recorded and those have been archived, as Gene mentioned. So if you missed an episode, hey, you know, we've got you covered. I've realized in working through these webinars that it takes a village to raise a webinar. We want speakers and topics. That's how we'll be able to continue the M2S2 webinar series. If you've got something to say about M2S2 related work, something to contribute to our community, this could be your opportunity. We're interested in any new ideas, topics, speakers for any future sessions, so please just drop me a line. And our first speaker today is Chris Evans. Chris is with the Army Corps of Engineers headquarters, and he's the Special Assistant for Military Munitions Support Services. And in that capacity, Chris provides the top-level integration and strategic direction for the Corps' munitions work. And he is, kind of functionally speaking, really my boss regarding the M2S2 webinars. So, Chris, please get us started on the main course for today's meal.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dwayne. It's really a pleasure to be here today. And since it is our fourth session of the webinar, I thought probably it would be a good time to start off by talking a little bit more about exactly what Military Munitions Support Services is and how the Corps of Engineers thinks about that. So that's really what I'm going to do for the next 15 minutes or so, is just walk you through how the Corps of Engineers thinks about M2S2, what types of programs are involved under this umbrella. We'll talk a little bit about the differences between how these programs are executed between CERCLA and non-CERCLA frameworks. And we'll look at some workload information, and then last I'm going to highlight some work you may not be familiar with that I think is very important and really demonstrates the depth and the breadth of what we're doing in the military munitions arena. So here is the obligatory definition of what M2S2 is all about and how we choose in the Army Corps of Engineers to look at it. Basically, it's anything we do that addresses unexploded ordnance, discarded military munitions, munitions constituents, or chemical warfare material, regardless of what entity we're doing that, whether it's military munitions response under the DIRP program, or we're working on operational ranges to sustain or improve those ranges, or even build new ones, and other construction support activities when we're engaged in activities in areas where there might be some type of explosive safety risk. And so we have two primary documents to sort of guide our behavior as an organization as we engage with our customers and stakeholders to do this work. We have an engineer regulation, 1110-1-8153, that was published back in June of 2010. And we also have a community of practice charter, which we signed back in December of 2011. And in fact, this webinar series is one of the functions and activities of that community of practice, to share information as broadly as we can with all of our Corps of Engineers staff, our industry representatives, our customers, and our stakeholders. This is probably the simplest way to present M2S2 in one picture, and I think it for those of you that have been to our workshop in previous years in Huntsville, you've probably seen this slide more than once. If you've heard me speak before, you've probably seen it as well. But it's really a good synopsis of everything that we see and do under the auspices of Military Munitions Support Services. Basically, we see it as four distinct mission areas, and I'm going to just walk you around what those four major mission areas are. First is our support to the combatant commanders. These are the war fighters and our overseas missions, and in that area we currently have two major operations underway. The largest of those, of course, is the UXO support and other battlefield mine clearance support that we're providing in Afghanistan, and I'm actually going to talk to you about that a little bit later. Near the end of my presentation to tell you about what we're doing in Afghanistan. And then we also do other international contingency operations throughout the world to support various clients and customers with their munitions issues. Moving around, most of you are probably familiar with DERP, or the Defense Environmental Restoration Program. That's where most of the people on the line, I suspect, make their living on a daily basis. Under DERP, we have the FUDS, or formerly used defense site, Military Munitions Response Program. We also do work for the Air Force and the Active Army. And then sort of related to that, although not funded by DERP, we have BRAC Environmental Restoration, but also that follows the basic rules of the Military Munitions Response Program. Continuing around, we get into a relatively new category that doesn't really fit into either DERP or operational range sustainment, and that's what we are now referring to as compliance cleanup or environmental quality work. Typically, these are the sites that require some type of cleanup or munitions response, but they're not eligible for DERP. Usually that's because they're on operational ranges or they're under an active RCRA permit, so they sort of get a category to themselves. And then the next major mission area is operational range sustainment. And here we're primarily geared to making sure that all of our soldiers and sailors and airmen have the facilities they need to be able to train effectively. And we do that through various programs, including our range maintenance programs, ORAP, or the Operational Range Assessment Program. And then we also have quite a significant amount of research and development activities through our engineering laboratories who look at ways to improve practices on ranges from environmental or cultural resources in order to allow that training continue. And then last, the fourth mission area is really has to do with the work we're doing here in the United States, primarily to support construction. Really, there's three flavors to that. One once again is on our ranges, where we're providing support for range modernization, range construction projects. The second is our support on MILCON or BRAC sites, where we're actually building new facilities for the military that may be on former ranges or former training areas. And then the last is support to our civil works missions. Typically, this is when we are engaged with dredging activities in waterways, or other places where there has been past history of munitions use. While we have a lot of different programs sort of under the M2S2 umbrella, the way that the Corps of Engineers execute this work is pretty consistent across the board. This is really how all this gets done. From a program management perspective, there is a national program manager assigned for each of those major balloons you saw on the previous slide. We have a coordination and oversight function through the Corps of Engineers divisions. Those are our regions across the country. And then the project execution is actually managed on a day-to-day basis in the project management districts where a project manager resides. And it's responsible of that project manager to assemble the right people and the right contracts and the right resources to deliver those projects. We do that through project delivery teams. And in the Corps of Engineers, that technical support for those teams comes from the specialized personnel and experienced personnel that we have. A lot of that experience rests in the Environmental and Munitions Center of Expertise, who are our co-hosts for this session today. But we also have 5 military munitions design centers across the country where we also have the bulk of our staff that does this work. And they're located in our Baltimore district, our Omaha district. We have a virtual team that operates out of our South Pacific and Southwestern divisions. And then we have 2 design centers in our Huntsville Center, one which handles conventional munitions and our OCONUS missions, and the other which works exclusively on chemical warfare material projects. Program is shaping up to look like. We're looking at about $345 million this year. You can see how the pie is divided up among all this various programs. And in preparing for this keynote presentation, I actually went through and calculated and determined just how much of the work we do is not under CERCLA. And I was, well, I wasn't completely surprised, but I knew it was a big number. But we actually, more than 50% of that $345 million will be done executing military munition support services and projects that are not under CERCLA. So, in fact, the majority of the work that the Corps of Engineers is doing in FY13 is in this non-CERCLA regulatory framework, or no regulatory framework at all. When you look a little more detail of where those frameworks are, and then I've also showed you some more information here on what the dollar values are, not just this year, but last year and projected for next year. The only program that the Corps of Engineers executes that's 100% CERCLA, or CERCLA all the time, is the FUDS, or formerly used defense site program. All the other programs that we are involved in either use some mix of a CERCLA and non-CERCLA frameworks based on site-specific conditions, or are not CERCLA at all. For example, the work we do for the Operational Range Assessment Program, our work overseas on international contingency operations, anything we're doing for range, sustainment, restoration, or modernization, and then the other work we do, primarily construction support and research, that's 100% non-CERCLA. And then for the programs that's sort of mixed, for example, the BRAC program, this year about 36% of the work we're doing is under non-CERCLA framework, most of that being RCRA. And for the Army and the Air Force MMRP work we're doing, that work is actually almost 60% RCRA. And then we have a little bit more additional CERCLA work under environmental quality, but the bulk of that work as well is also done non-CERCLA. And that gets into some of the more interesting regulatory frameworks, including things such as the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, and Safe Water Drinking Act. This is sort of the last slide on the whole workload trend business. I've been showing this for a while now because it's pretty illustrative of how bumpy a ride we have, and certainly sequestration is not going to help us, but we are sort of coming off of a peak for workload. Our biggest year was actually back in FY11 when we did just over $500 million in work. Leading up to that peak, we're averaging just under $400 million a year, but going forward, we're actually going to be doing significantly less, at least for the next couple years, probably in the range of $300 to $340 million a year. We may start to pick up again in the future. Of course, that all depends on what Congress decides to do. But it is sort of interesting to see where the workload is. You'll notice that really, really big spike in the FY10 and FY11 region. A lot of that was due primarily to some reprogramming actions in DOD, also the ARRA funding also contributed there, but you can sort of see, you know, what the trends are from a program level across the board. The last thing I'm going to do before I open it up for any questions you might have is I did want to highlight what I think are probably two of the more interesting projects that we're doing right now that are not in the CERCLA framework. They're both work we're doing to support the warfighters in Afghanistan. The first is the Mine and Battle Area Clearance Program. And basically the scope of this program is to clear lands in Afghanistan, operating out of the Mine Action Center of Bagram Air Force Base, to support everything that U.S. forces, Afghanistan, and our transatlantic division need to complete their missions. So it's a mixture of mine clearance and also construction support activities. We have right now a contract in place with EODT for $62 million for this work through December of this year. And EODT has over 1,000 people currently working on this project, most of those being local nationals from Afghanistan. They've done some really great work over there. It's really allowed our forces to do the things they need to do in a safe manner, whether it's building new facilities for the Afghan security forces or taking care of some remnant issues from previous conflicts in the region. And to date, that team has cleared over 1.7 million square meters of land and recovered and destroyed over 4,700 MEC items. And you can see some photographs there of some of the activities of the teams that are doing this work. The second project we have going on in Afghanistan that I wanted to highlight for y'all today is our Joint Munitions Disposal Program. The scope of this effort is basically to collect and destroy explosive remnants of war, primarily unserviceable munitions from U.S. and our allies in country. And that's a pretty important task because destroying these things is important so that they don't get into the wrong people's hands. And so we have another contract there with EODT worth $25 million that has a period of performance through April of next year. We've got about 50 people in country working on that project right now, and to date, they've destroyed over 1,140 tons of unserviceable munitions and 307 tons of small arms ammunition. So that's pretty much what I wanted to cover today, and looking at the clock, I've got some time. I'd be more than happy to take any questions from the field.
If we have any questions for Chris, please be sure to use your question and answer window and submit those right now. I don't see any. None have come in, Chris, but we'll give it just a couple of minutes to see if someone does want to post a question.
Well, people are thinking about the question. This is one of my go-to slides that I carry around with me everywhere. Once again, the three R's message is on the screen, recognize, retreat, and report. But this also shows you quite the breadth of work that the Corps of Engineers is involved in. Just sort of running through the photographs you see on there in the upper left-hand corner, this picture here is some chemical warfare material, munitions, CWM munitions, from our Spring Valley, formerly used defense site in Washington, D.C. These were buried in a pit and were recovered under a vapor containment structure so that they could be destroyed. Corner, some work we did up in the New England region. This is a magnetometer system on a helicopter that was used to do some wide area assessment surveys on the beaches there. And then in the bottom, right-hand corner, you can see a photograph from some work that was done in Ordnance Reef in Hawaii. This was an underwater set of demonstrations and investigations, and the Corps of Engineers provided support during some of the remedial investigation work there. And this particular photograph shows a robotic recovery of a munitions item from the seafloor.
Excellent. Chris, I think that your go-to slide has stimulated some questions. We do have a handful of questions here. First one that popped up was, does your office also provide emergency operations?
That's a good question. By regulation and by policy in DOD, emergency operations is performed by military uniformed EOD units, explosive ordnance disposal units. So basically, they are the first responders. There have been situations in the past where they've gotten into more than they could deal with based on their emergency response, and we have provided support to them across the country and have worked in conjunction with them. But for the most part, for DOD, it's the active duty military EOD units that provide that service.
Okay. Will there continue to be work in Afghanistan since the U.S. presence is supposed to end there in 2014?
Well, I would sort of caution that question is that I don't believe that that's entirely true. My understanding is the final determination of what the U.S. presence and involvement in Afghanistan after 2014 is not completely clear yet. We do know that most of our troops will be out of Afghanistan by 2014, but there may be continuing requirements over there for construction, for training, and for other activities. And so we are actually currently engaged in discussions and planning scenarios to provide some level of support in Afghanistan after 2014 if it's required.
Okay. How much, referring back to your dollar slide, how much of the $44 million of SRM was for operational range clearance?
Is actually a pretty small amount. I'm going to say, it's been a while since I looked at the numbers, it's probably between 10 and 15 million of that is actually for what I would call operation and maintenance range clearance activities. The bulk of that funding is for larger range modernization projects, the support of those projects.
Okay, very good. I think we have time for one last question, and this question alone, I think that we could spend an entire webinar on it, Chris, so you can make a stab at it in 90 seconds or less. Do you have general guidelines to identify UXO NEC on military bases? What's the process of identifying and removing UXO?
I'm certainly not probably qualified to answer that. I'm not DOD trained. But the definitions of what the difference are between MEC, UXO, and DMM are pretty well established and are in all our guidance documents. We do rely on the technical expertise of the people that have the qualifications to do this work. As I mentioned earlier, for emergency responses, that's our uniformed military EOD. We also have, within the Corps of Engineers, civilian staff, most who are military veterans from EOD units who serve as our experts on UXO items that are called Ordnance and Explosive Safety Specialists. And then certainly we rely on the expertise in industry as well, and the UXO technicians, both former military and commercially trained, who make up probably the large part of our workforce in doing this work. So we really rely on them to make those determinations.
Excellent, Chris. Very good job. Very good speaker. And this speaker is Ms. Kim Meacham. Kim is she's been with the Corps of Engineers with the Huntsville Center since 2000. Kim serves as a project engineer and technical manager on munitions projects, and she supports both the conventional Military Munitions Design Center and the CWM Design Center there. I've had the pleasure of working with Kim on projects in the past, and I've got to say that Kim works tirelessly on these projects. So I think that we're very fortunate to have Kim willing to give us her perspective and her thoughts and input on non-circular work. So Kim, with that, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thanks, Dwayne. I I have not worked under RCRA facilities for very long. So my objectives for this particular presentation is to basically do the mile-high view of what RCRA is. And I think I got that backwards. I've worked under CERCLA mostly, not RCRA. Anyway, with the agenda, of course, I said it's the mile-high view. Then I wanted to try to do a bit of a comparison between RCRA and CERCLA. For those who are just totally not familiar at all with the RCRA process. Then I wanted to follow up with a few discussions about the solid waste management units, hazard waste management units, and munition response sites, and how they sometimes work in with the RCRA permit. I'm also going to cover a few of those particular types of sites that I have worked on. RCRA is the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, which is by law, and was enacted in 1976. It is the way that the government can regulate the generation, transport, treatment, and storage, also the disposal of solid waste and hazardous waste. RCRA was enacted by Congress to require proper management of waste generated at existing sites. Now, the guidance I have there is not strictly on RCRA, but Chapter 9 has a good discussion of the RCRA aspects that basically I'm trying to cover. And as necessary, Congress has done amendments to RCRA to keep up with the continued problems that have come up with managing the waste that we produce in our country. So they have, the amendment they have come up with is called the Hazardous and Solid Waste Amendments. Under the provisions of the Hazardous and Solid Waste Amendments, Congress established the authority for corrective action, which CERCLA folks, that's the remedial action requirements, at permitted or the interim status, and I'll get into that in a little bit, hazardous waste management facilities. And some states are RCRA authorized states. I'm also going to explain that in a slide. And they have the states have the authority to regulate the hazardous and solid waste within their states. These authorized RCRA states are, they achieve primacy from EPA through the, EPA's acceptance of their, either their legislation, rules, codes, however that state wants to, you know, promulgate their control of the hazardous and solid waste. So I just have a little example here. Georgia created their own RCRA guidance, and this particular guidance is how you select media remediation levels at solid waste management units. And Utah has an administrative code, and it's the Environmental Quality Solid and Hazardous Waste. Now, under RCRA, there are a couple of parts that have to be done, which is Part A. It's the application process. You either have to provide the EPA Form 8700-23, or the state may also have their own forms, but it's basically the higher level just identification of the site, general maps, drawings, photographs, and it's the requirement in the 40 CFR 270.13. And facilities can obtain an interim status until they can get a Part B permit issued. Okay, and that's obviously because there's so not as much data required. That is just the interim status once you receive the Part A approvals. Part B is much, much more detailed and has specific requirements for the site in that permit. The facility trying to get the permit will have to negotiate with the regulators to the level of, simply monitoring, inspection, the plans they have to do, and post-closure conditions, and then there's all the attachments that are the plans, management, et cetera. Excuse me. As I mentioned, the other attachments, you may have to do air modeling depending upon what the facility does, if it does treatment and has to, that, you know, maybe they burn stuff, they have to have their air permits. The management of the waste, analysis plans, how you're going to analyze the waste, how often the state or EPA will come out to the site, what types of inspections they'll do, potentially maybe checklists. All these additional plans are built, negotiated, and placed into the permit when it's issued. And if violations are found during their inspections or, you know, et cetera, there can be at times stiff penalties and fines. So this is very important stuff. The Solid Waste Management Unit and the Hazardous Waste Management Unit, those are units that are listed underneath the permit. At these RCRA permitted facilities, it's basically the regulator is the lead agency, and environmental remediation can be required and is required when necessary. And basically you have to follow the programmatic requirements or legal requirements of RCRA, and then within the state's purview, they can have other requirements also, and those must be met and are covered by the regulators. In the past, the Solid Waste Management Unit used to be called an Operable Management Unit. That may be more familiar to some people. Now, in the comparison between RCRA and CERCLA, there's almost a one-to-one type of comparison, with the exception of CERCLA has a site inspection requirement and based on our typical CERCLA-type preliminary assessment. It can require sampling and other greater detail than just a preliminary assessment. So it's kind of considered the equivalent to a CERCLA site inspection. And it really truly is, when you're getting into the remediation point part of it or the cleanup, it is really just a slightly different apple. And I will go further into detail later on some of the greater differences. Okay, here another comparison goes on forward. Now, in CERCLA, if you're not an MPL site, it's considered a decision document. Um, Now, for my particular solid waste management units that I've worked at, the first one I wanted to cover basically had multiple burial pits, had munitions or buried drums, etc., open burning in pits, or just basically dumping stuff into trenches. And we also had open burn, open detonation sites, including lots of ash piles in the area. Now, this burial and disposal operation started prior to the facility applying for their RCRA permit. So once this area was rolled into that permit as a solid waste management unit to be covered under the permitting process. Our objectives at this site were specifically to stabilize the surface area, to get rid of all the hazardous or solid waste materials from the surface of the site. We were trying to clear out kickouts from adjacent OBOD sites. We had removal of the materials from the pits and trenches, which, you know, bomb bodies, drums, munitions packaging materials, prop charge cases, anyway, all the types of materials that you might find associated with transporting munitions were in pits out there. And then we wanted to collect surface samples, burial pits that were covered. We still wanted to do the surface clearance on those burial pits, but we didn't want to do anything at all that would disturb the surface. So if there was something that was embedded and did require any kind of digging to get it out, we were not going to remove those. And then additionally, we had to dispose of all the conventional munitions that we did find out there. And this included a large, very large quantity of incendiaries. Now, the aspects that directly related to the RCRA permit, basically that we were required to do air modeling because we were, like I said, going to have to dispose of a large number of incendiaries, and the best way to do that is to burn them. So once the air modeling is completed or was completed, then a modification to the permit could be obtained or approved by the regulators. Any items that were unacceptable to move and we had to blow in place, they could not be moved to a permitted OBOD site, had to have an emergency destruct permit. Because of the fact that we had a lot of drums out at the site and the potential for those drums to contain stuff, they weren't all empty, we went ahead and did all our characterization so that we could do our proper manifesting and getting everything ready for shipment within the SMU. And that made it so that we didn't have to have any secondary waste storage areas or any of the 90-day aspects that can come up under RCRA. Now, for the second SMU and also the hazardous waste management unit that I've also worked at, in both cases, we were trying to get to closure for both units. For the solid waste management unit, we had to perform an interim removal first. Once we did the removal, we collected confirmatory samples to determine the presence or absence. And of course, this is required for closure. If at that time we did find that some of the soils did have contamination, we have plans to remove the contaminated soils and then resample to again confirm that all the contamination was removed. And then we would prepare the required closure documentation as specified in the RCRA Part B permit for this site. The same, pretty much the same thing went for the hazardous waste management unit. We had to go in and sample the areas to determine presence or absence. And at that point, if there was absence, then we could go forward with our closure documentation. Now the specifics, again, for this, especially the solid waste management unit, we expected to have lots of incendiaries at this site also. So we had to do our modeling for the method of burning these incendiaries for this particular solid waste management unit. Of course, when we got into the burial pit, we found different types of items. So once again, we're going to have to go and model those items, and so we can modify the permit again in order to handle the destruction of these items. And again, similar to the other SMU, if we found any items that were unacceptable to move, that we would also have to request an emergency strut permit. Now, the closure plan, as I mentioned before, is an agreed to plan of closure with the regulators, and this is a part of the RCRA permit. And some RCRA permits require different levels of risk assessment, different protocols. So this particular facility requires us to use the EPA regional screening levels. That enables us to have a larger set of constituents that we can sample for rather than just the base constituents required under RCRA. And let me see. This facility also had negotiated with the regulators to come up with a facility-wide quality assurance project plan and also a facility-wide risk assumptions document. All this was part of the RCRA permit. Now, I kind of wanted to point this out for those who are not very familiar with RCRA. And parts of the closure requires certain cost estimating to be done for the closure. It's a closure estimate, you know, financial assurances, mechanism for closure, liability requirements, and state financial mechanisms. Well, basically, under the federal government, federal government facilities are exempt from these financial requirements. So if you're working at a site and someone mentions this, is if you're in the federal government, just be quite aware that we are not required to do this. And I'm not quite sure what the consequences may be if we do that, but there's always the potential for expenditure of funds that we're not allowed to do. Now, under the MRS that I have worked at, Munitions Response Site, well, in general, at a RCRA facility, you may be able to do a RCRA analysis of the site or investigation of the site, but the regulators may also allow you just to follow the typical CERCLA process of investigating a munitions response site. The important thing here is if the regulator does allow you to follow CERCLA, you still have to implement or follow the substantive requirements of the permit and have slightly different protocols and requirements from CERCLA. Okay, for my specific project that I worked on, we just had a site. They had historically some munitions burial pits, not really large, just small caches of DMM, discarded military munitions, and potentially some open burning or dumping trenches. And also the site had barracks on it. So, but that goes into more of the UXO, QD arcs, et cetera, and I wasn't going to get into that, but for the RCRA process specifically, our objectives at the site for our RCRA facility investigation was to reacquire and resolve anomalies that had been selected under a previous digital geophysical mapping process that was done by the geophysicists here in Huntsville. After we resolved the anomalies, we were going to sample underneath the munitions that were found and then follow up with a RCRA facility investigation report. And if at that time it was determined to be necessary, we would perform a corrective measure study and determine any necessary path forward. Specifics to the RCRA permit. For this particular site, there wasn't a whole lot of difference from CERCLA. We still did it as a RCRA facility investigation, but it, as I said, there really wasn't a lot of difference other than just simply the name of the investigation. We had, if necessary, disposal of the discarded military munitions, or if we found anything that was unacceptable to move, we, again, in this case, at this facility, we had to have an emergency permit. And our risk assessment will also follow the protocols in the RCRA permit rather than the typical CERCLA methods of doing risk assessment. And basically, because everybody likes to see things blow up, I went ahead and threw a couple of picture sequences of items that we have detonated in our cleanup processes. Just a note, particularly the photographs and everything that I have included were not specific to any of my RCRA sites, but they were intended to illustrate the work that can be done. But if anybody has any questions, I will try to answer them.
Excellent, Kim. Very much appreciate it. I loved the little video. Unfortunately, we didn't have the sound, though. That's what would have made it really awesome. and I saw one of the guys, though. I was really confused. This must have been a Corps of Engineers employee who was looked like he was holding one ear, but the other one was open. But anyway, now we do have a couple of questions that have come in, Kim. The first one is kind of a twofer. It's a two-parter, and I'm going to give you the easy portion first. So how do you deal with, and this is regarding OBOD unit, although this first part is a little more generic, but how do you deal with potential explosive safety issues, for example, you know, items that are on the ground when installing groundwater monitoring systems?
Well, I basically said I would try. And we have that situation coming up on one of the sites I'm working on. Because of the fact that typically you're required to do anomaly avoidance, as I said, I would try to answer the question. You would basically potentially have to install the well in an area where there are no anomalies. I mean, the whole point I'm trying to make is you shouldn't be drilling a well in an OBOD site or close enough to an OBOD site that you're detecting anomalies, because you certainly don't want to blow up your drill rig. There are methods of doing downhole monitoring as you drill. There is the ability to, once you get to a certain depth, if under probability assessment and potentially a CORA, if you get to that depth, you may be able to agree that the anomaly avoidance is no longer necessary, because it would be unlikely that any items would be below that depth. But this is basically the important issue, is the anomaly avoidance, so you don't, you know, damage people or your drill rigs.
Okay. Yeah, and I'll just elaborate on that a little bit, Kim. The Corps of Engineers does have very specific guidance about conducting anomaly avoidance that was written specifically for instances such as this. So the spectrum really runs from conducting anomaly avoidance, in other words, installing the groundwater monitoring wells where there are no subsurface anomalies, to the other end of the spectrum, where if that is simply not feasible and you have to have a well in a specific location, to conducting a subsurface clearance in that particular area. So, you know, really the full spectrum of tools is available to us. The second part of the question, and this is the one that, anyway, from my perspective anyway, Kim, was a little bit tougher. And if you need a hand with it, I think that we have Ed Bave who may pipe in and help out with it also. But it's, again, for an OBOD unit. How do you define the unit boundary and point of compliance under RCRA?
I'm going to toss that one over to Ed.
Ed, are you live? Can we get you to chime in a little bit on that one?
Well, I that is. So there's going to be a lot of flexibility on the part of the permit writer and the installation to negotiate that. But if it's a true Subpart X, you know, permitted unit, then I think the boundaries are going to be pretty well defined within the permit in terms of what that unit consists of, the footprint. And then it's going to be, you know, a question of, you know, the safety factors associated with the operation of that unit, you know, getting in there and making a determination, like Dwayne said, where if you're looking about point of compliance with respect to groundwater contamination, then I think we're right back to kind of what Dwayne was saying. So it really depends on, you know, whether it's an interim status unit, the status of the permit per se for the facility, and then how well demarcated that operation was, and what the status of the unit is, whether it's continuing to operate or if it's going under closure. So it's going to be negotiated with the regulators.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Ed. Next question, Kim. What was the average time frame for the completion of these projects?
Well, one of them is a chemical warfare material site. Those always take a lot longer than your conventional sites because documentation and approval, et cetera, just seems to take longer. And then you have your pre-operational surveys, your Huntsville survey, tabletop exercises, and basically what we call the MACOM or DA pre-op. So all this tends to add up to a lot longer project for a CWM site. For the munitions response site documentation, I would say this one, because it was fast-tracked, we probably will be done within 18 months. But there is a wide range depending upon, you know, the work that you have to do, how large the site is, et cetera, et cetera, the work you have negotiated that's required to be done with your regulators. It will vary tremendously based on the site.
Got it. So it's hard really to pin a meaningful average since there are so many variables associated with it. Okay. Another question that came in, Kim, was you seem to have obtained an emergency permit for all of your BIPs. It's my understanding that BIPs are considered Class 1, 2 emergencies and don't require emergency permits. Would you please explain why you obtained emergency permits?
The regulators gave us permission on the basis that we would notify them and then they would provide us the emergency permit. This is specifically, I would assume, based on the fact that these two facilities, that is what they agreed to with their regulators.
Okay.
Dwayne, this is Chris Evans. I think there's also a distinction between when you're operating on a permitted site and when there's an emergency response off installation. There may be some confusion there in the question.
Correct. I think that's a good point, Chris. I mean, what's the regulatory driver for the air modeling?
I toss that one to Ed, too. The requirement is clean air. I mean, we cannot pollute the air. And the regulators understand that, and within the permit, the RCRA permit established it at this particular facility, they already had to have air modeling done to gain their permit because of the work going on at this site. So we could not introduce additional contamination into the air that would exceed the allowable limits within the RCRA permit. Therefore, we had to model the particulates, et cetera, that went along, that go along with your typical air modeling requirements so that we could modify the permit, and that would then dictate how much we could burn per year, per day, what weather conditions, et cetera, that we could do our work under.
Yeah, and I'll let Ed jump in case I misspeak here, because it's been a number of years since I dealt with an OBOD unit. But I believe, if I recall correctly, air modeling is actually part of the Subpart X requirements.
Yeah, obviously the media transfer aspect is an important part of Subpart X. And just to piggyback on what Kim said on a facility that I've been working on recently, what they were concerned about was keeping the thresholds below a certain limit so that the air quality folks didn't have to issue a Clean Air Act permit or add another source to the operation that was going on at the facility. So the RCRA folks were working with the Clean Air Act folks and saying that, you know, it was basically a minor source, and if they kept it under these levels of emissions, that it wouldn't trigger a Clean Air Act permit per se.
Okay. We have one more question that came in, and this one is very, very broad, very general. And so, I mean, Kim, if you want to make a stab at it, that's fine. If anyone else wants to jump in, that's fine also. But it's how should a private land developer approach a potential MEC situation?
Well, Duane, that reminds me of a point that I was going to try to make that I forgot, and it's associated with FUDs. If we have a FUDs munition response site within a RCRA facility, meaning, and my intent here is if it's, you know, a privately owned RCRA facility or commercially owned, whatever, if it's not a federal or facility, RCRA facility, it's a true FUDS site within a RCRA permitted facility, we still have to perform the work or investigation of that FUDS facility or FUDS site as a CERCLA remedial process, not the RCRA process. And I'm not quite sure if that's the direction they were intending with their question, but if you have a private facility, RCRA permitted facility, and there is a FUD site on it, the FUD site still has to follow CERCLA.
Right. And I guess my thoughts, I mean, I was looking at it even from a little higher elevation. I was, you know, I was thinking that any landowner, any developer, anybody, a potential MEC situation, if they have encountered an item or a suspicious item, then again, they really need to follow the three R's, you know, recognize, retreat, report, notify the authorities of the potential items that may be there so that they can be responded to safely. If they're looking at property that it may be FUDs, then again, you know, kind of like Kim was saying there, I would encourage the developer to contact the appropriate Corps of Engineers district or even a state or a federal regulator and can start discussing the specifics of the site itself and see what process it needs to follow. I don't see any other questions that have come in. If anybody wants to elaborate on the question and responses that we have provided, or if you have additional questions, we'll wait just a couple of seconds for it. Otherwise, our next presentation is scheduled to begin at 15:45. And because people, you know, with this particular webinar forum, you know, people can dial in for a specific presentation. If it's something that really tickles their fancy, they may dial in for just a portion of the webinar. For that reason, we try not to start the presentation before their scheduled time in case somebody has blocked off the time to dial in. So we're not going to start the presentation, the next one, early. If there aren't any other questions, and I don't see that any others have come in, then we're going to take looks like about a 5-minute break, and we will start the next presentation crisply at 15:15. Thank you. Hey, Gene, should be 5 minutes. Should be 15:15, not 15-minute break.
This is Jean Balance, just doing a very quick audio check. Appreciate everybody's patience as I do the sound check in the background. Again, we are currently on break, and we'll resume the technical portion of the broadcast.
Okay, Jean, I think that we are ready to, I think it's time for us to get started again. Are you back online? Okay, I'm not sure. We're having a little bit of audio, a couple of audio issues that we're working through. I'm going to ask Mike, are you online? Can you hear me? Okay,
yes,
excellent. Well, we'll go ahead then. We'll proceed with it. And our next presenter is Mr. Mike Heitman. And Mike's with CH2M Hill. And he has worked on both RCRA and CERCLA projects for over 20 years doing site characterizations and site investigations. And has been working on munitions response sites for about the last 7 years. So Mike's going to talk to us a little bit about some groundwater monitoring requirements, meeting some groundwater monitoring requirements under RCRA. So Mike, I believe the floor is yours.
Hi, thank you, Dwayne. This talk will dovetail nicely into Kim's. They're similar type sites with similar type problems. I'm going to focus more on one specific issue that we had and how it was resolved. Again, name's Mike Heitman with CH2M Hill. I appreciate the opportunity to do this talk. I apologize for the presentation background. I don't know if the Army Corps has classes on how to do these PowerPoints, or if you guys have better templates, but your presentations are always way cooler than anything I come up with. So with that, I will go ahead and get started. So what we'll be doing is an introduction, a little bit about Camp Navajo's history, the regulatory history. Again, we're looking at a CERCLA RCRA issue. The site is a RCRA site for reasons I'll get into. A lot of the work done under CERCLA, but how the two kind of mix and match and how you can kind of navigate by working with your regulators through some of the issues that you'll get to. We will talk about the data collection and analysis issues that kind of basically generated the concern or the problem that we're going to talk about. We'll talk about alternatives to the typical post-closure monitoring well network, and then vadozone is a word you're going to hear, and vadozone monitoring results. That's the term we use for what came out of this project or this task. Okay, so I said the objectives: present the site and regulatory history, establish the regulatory requirements and corresponding issues, and discuss the process and resolution. And, you know, before I move on, you know, need to make sure I acknowledge a few people. Special thanks to Randy Wilkinson. He's a contractor with Stell who works with the Army National Guard at Camp Navajo, who, you know, would be kind of a co-author, co-presenter on this if he was online. ADEQ, the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality, we have had, since I've been on here, a very good working relationship with them and a partnering relationship. And, of course, the Army National Guard Directorate, we've had some very quality oversight and direction, you know, people who have passed through, good three or four of them, some of them off in other places now. And then the Arizona National Guard, again, very supportive and very collaborative in how we did this project. So Camp Navajo's history, you know, it was active starting in 1942. Camp Navajo is in Flagstaff, Arizona, since you probably don't say that till further down. So if you're Googling it, it's in Arizona. It's up in the mountains. It was assigned a Defense Supply Agency Depot mission in 67, placed under reserve status in 71, reassigned to Tool Army Depot in 75. Arizona Guard assumed operational control in 82, transferred under BRAC 1 to Arizona National Guard in 93. The OBOD operations, which were a component of this base, you know, for the majority of its history, ended in 94. The environmental cleanup, of course, started right away in 95, and then it's currently classified as a maneuver training center light. And that's kind of important, and you'll see a couple of slides later. So the regulatory history, the Arizona Army National Guard submitted for a Part A permit and then a Part B. And as Kim said, Part A permit, I think it's two pages. It might be three. It's very easy to fill out. It's very quick. It's just a little bit of information, and you send it in. Part B is considerably onerous. It is everything you're going to do, how you're going to do it, what are going to be the results of what you're going to do, how you're going to close the site, and if you will need to, how will you monitor your closure afterwards. So that's a large document. It's a very complicated document. So a lot of sites operate under interim status for a long period. You get the interim status as soon as you submit the A. You get your full status when your B is approved. In this case, the B was never approved. For people who work in RCRA, what you're going to be finding out is the B always kind of is your roadmap on how to close. And the optimism that the closure was filled out with before the site was started is incredible with what they thought would happen. But anyway. So at that point, you're in the permit facility. You're operating under the interim permit. It's just like operating under the regular permit with a little small difference. And in the interim permit, you're under CFR 265. When you get your permit, you're under CFR 264, which in a lot of cases, if you pull the two together, they're word for word. One of the main differences, 265 interim status doesn't allow you subpart X, which is what you kind of need to do this work. So you kind of sit there in no man's land as far as how you operate. As they started, like I said, right after they stopped operation. They started the cleanup, which was really more of the investigation phase as they were trying to sort out what's going on at the facility and what the impacts were. And I think the communication with the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality at AEQ wasn't there, so there were concerns that this was being neglected. So the site went through a contentious stretch where you had letters from the governor going to the Secretary of Defense and the Congress, and then to get the site back on track, you started having these high-level meetings between, you know, the Army National Guard and ADQ. And around 2003, a new technical lead, at the time Major Bill Meyer, was brought in, and based on some of the things he learned from his previous work, first thing you want to do is establish a relationship, a stakeholder-type relationship with ADEQ. So he met with them a lot. He developed processes and procedures to work with them. So there was an agreement that we accept the process, you accept the results. So in 2004, one of the first agreements they got, which was important, is they decided to separate the investigation of the HTRW versus the investigation of the MEC. And, you know, one of the differences you'll see is designated that the HTRW designations are called NADS, which are Navajo Army Ammunition Depots, the original titles. Because the OBOD, is particularly the open detonation operations, tended to scatter things, kick out, those boundaries could extend beyond the NADS, so they were called Munitions Response Work Areas. Now, even that kind of, when they worked through that, was a lesson in the communication, because ADQ was initially a little reluctant to it, because you're telling them that you're going to go in and you're going to do the haz waste work under avoidance. And if you're not familiar with how that works, they're thinking what you're going to do is avoid the areas that have a lot of munitions debris and a lot of potential MEC in it. Well, then aren't you avoiding the areas that have the highest potential for contamination? So what they agreed on is that it would be avoidance to the location that you were tending to sample, and then you would clear out anything you needed to gain the samples, that within reason samples wouldn't be moved out of the area based just on presence of MEC, but you would, you know, do the removal and get your samples. Then they also agreed that the sites and site work should be done under CERCLA, and a lot of that is because, as was said earlier, CERCLA is better designed, particularly for MEC operations. It's guided more towards that. It works a little better. RECRA can be used, but the agreement was made, and the way it would work is that you would do everything in CERCLA up to the point that you were ready to close the site, or do you think you've achieved closure, or whatever closure would be. And then you transitioned over to RECRA, because that's where the permit was, and that's where you had to close out the site. You know, in 2007, they did the NAD02 RI, which was for the munitions constituents. In 2008, the MEC characterization was done, and by 2011, the ECA was done. So as you're getting towards the end, you have to start working through that process of how are you going to make that transition from CERCLA to RECRA. You kind of see a picture of the site, beautiful area, it'd make a great campground or retirement area. The first thing you have to do is kind of look at what were the requirements of RECRA, what was supposed to be in place, you know, that the RECRA group was supposed to be meeting. And there were no closure plans because there was no Part B that had been finalized. So RECRA said, well, you guys are doing work under CERCLA. It's being overseen, you know, by ADEQ also. So we're going to count those documents as the closure plans. And then we'll look towards a decision document, a CERCLA-style decision document for both the MEC and the MC, or the chemical hazards, as your closure, as you're saying, we've moved this site as far along as we can, you know, now it goes to the record group, you know, to do the closure and to kind of take it the rest of the way. One other thing that we had to do is you have to have a post-closure plan as part of RCRA. So we did have to draft up a post-closure plan and put it in there as draft and update it a few times. So the site remains in interim status, and then it will be closed, and a RCRA post-closure permit will be issued. Because what happened in there is, and let me go to the next slide, because that's what we really want to talk about. It's, well, this is the how it is to RCRA, kind of talking about what Kim was. It's RCRA because the items were sent there were intended for disposal. And, you know, I'm not going to say it verbatim, but I'm going to get pretty close. A waste is any item that is intended for disposal. If that item meets any of the characteristics of a hazardous waste or was generated in a means that results in a listed waste, then it is considered a hazardous waste. So the waste clarification that occurs for these MEC items is a result of what the intended purpose was, which was disposal. This was a disposal facility. So military munitions were sent to Camp Navajo for disposal through open burner, open detonation under hazardous waste manifest, you know, when they were in existence. So what happens is the items that did not get disposed of, in other words, the treatment failed, that were kicked out, they're still waste because that's what they started as. So it's considered a waste that you left in place. So, you know, that kind of kicks it into the record, into the terminology, and which kind of, for a lot of the people on this call have done this through CERCLA, is kind of the head-scratching moment where why, you know, wait a minute, these typically aren't waste. Well, this was because it was generated that way. I mean, to the point that the item that was started to be detonated was a sent there as a waste. It was a hazardous waste. The item was blown up. The hazard was removed. The explosive was taken away during the open detonation. What remained was the MD. Well, that MD is actually considered by the regulator as a solid waste because it was still intended for disposal. But when you're out there and you pick it up and you decide and you remove it for recycling, it's no longer a waste because you changed the intended purpose. Now, what happened at the site was, over the course of its history, the numbers vary, but they're never less than tens of millions to hundreds of millions of items were disposed of there. And hundreds of millions of items turns into, you know, potentially a billion pieces of MD. So even if you blew up 100 million items and you may have 3 or 4,000 still left out there, your percentage of treatment is pretty good. But you can't find easily those items that were kicked out. It's not looking for a needle in a haystack because you can engineer around a needle in a haystack because one's metal and one's not. It's looking for a sewing needle in a pile of hypodermic needles. And you realize that you're wading through these to find these MEC items, and the cost, the level of effort, and the potential risk to doing it wasn't there. The site, like I said, is a training base, so you're able to essentially establish the area that says this is where the waste is going to be left in place. And to go back to one of the questions someone else had earlier, you know, like where's the compliance point, well, typically it's at the end of your operational boundary. And when the site starts, your operational boundary is where you're doing the detonations. The items that get kicked out of your boundaries require a corrective action, or they require you to reestablish your boundaries, which is what we did. We reestablished, you know, the boundaries of where the waste would be left in site, where the permitted area would be. Now, what that gets you into is a problem that, not a problem, but an issue that we knew existed from the very beginning and then transformed to a different regulatory requirement, which made us still have to deal with it. If you're doing a closing down a site, there's a groundwater monitoring requirement typically for RCRA. It'll say, it's fairly specific even, one up, two down, you know, wells to determine if your operations caused any impact to the water table, to the first water table. There are exceptions to that. If you can show the regulators that you didn't generate a lot of liquid waste or urine in an arid region and you wouldn't be susceptible to leaching, you know, you can get out of it. You can get it exempted. It's probably not that usual to happen. You know, the thought was in this site is because there was a chemical investigation done, and at least initially there was the thought that all the MEC would be removed, that you could be looking at a clean closure, and because there's nothing remaining in soil and some monitoring done in some offset wells, that you could get that exemption from doing the groundwater monitoring. But what happens when you start leaving the waste in place is now you kick into another requirement, and that's that you have to have, if you have a post-closure permit, you have to have a final groundwater monitoring program. You have to have something in place that can serve as detection monitoring, you know, close to the waste left in place that allow you to make decisions as to whether your closure is effective, that the items are not, or the waste you left in place is not further impacting the environment. So where you initially you thought you were going to get out of putting in some wells because you thought you had you met the technical requirements, now you're back to, well, we have to do some post-closure care monitoring. And there's the reason that we want to avoid doing this post-closure monitoring, you'll see in the next slide. And that is that the first aquifer is roughly 1,400 feet through a mountain. You've got probably 6 to 30 feet of soil over fracture and faulted limestone and sandstone bedrock that you have to go down through to get to the first real water-bearing unit. Where I say the pathway for the source to receptor is unknown, what we're saying is we know it snows there, we know it rains, we see water pond up, and we see water go away. Where exactly it's going, there's not a water balance. How much of it's being evapotransmitted, how much of it is, you know, making its way to the first water-bearing unit, and where is that first water-bearing unit where it's interacting? Because of the fractures, you wouldn't necessarily expect it to go straight down. So that's where you get into the groundwater monitoring may not detect a release no matter how many wells. One of the things that the ADEQ and the GARD and we agreed on is, you know, those deep wells may not do any good because you're always going to be suspicious of the results. If you put in that deep well and you pull out a water sample and it's clean, does that mean that there were no impacts, or does that mean that the fractures are going the other way and you're just in the wrong spot? So the data would always be in question. Also, the purpose is, and this next bullet is worded poorly, the purpose of detection monitoring is for you to find out that your wastes are being released to the environment in a timely manner such that you can correct it before you have an environmental impact. And if you're making this detection at a monitoring well, you know, that is, you know, 1,400 feet below ground and probably, you know, a good half mile from the potential source area, that's really too late to make a corrective action. You know, now you're kind of going in a backwards mode to, well, it's here, now we can deal with it at the point, but the detection monitoring was for it to never get to a point where it would come into contact, you know, with residential people. There's also the cost. You know, a rough order of magnitude cost was $1.2 million per monitoring well. It could take a long time to drill. Also, if you remember that picture, there weren't any electrical lines around there. There is no electric out there. So you would have, you're not going to bail a well that deep, so now you're looking at, you know, having to bring out generators and such. So it was not something you wanted to do, and it did not seem like it was technically feasible, but that doesn't give you the pathway to do nothing. So we looked at alternatives. We looked at, what about a mass transfer model? We have a, you know, decent idea of what's left out there. We know what the munitions constituents are, so what if we estimated the number of items, estimated a release period, estimated a amount of water flow through it, then estimated a point of compliance? Well, If you say estimated more than once or twice in what you're thinking about, you probably don't want to go down that road because you have too many variables. If you're estimating everything, you'll have a hard time getting concurrence on it. You can go to lysimeters. Lysimeters are designed for measuring soil moisture. They essentially create a negative vacuum to where they suck in soil moisture from the vado zone. It would have been a good tool to use because you wouldn't be relying upon necessarily precipitation events or snowfall at such where you had free flow, just enough to get enough water into the vado zone that it could be withdrawn. Another thing that was looked at was, what about an intermediate bedrock dry well with a sump? What if we go into this area and instead of trying to drill to 1,400 feet, you drill to a couple hundred feet and you have a sump in there where you can collect the water? You know, when the water does flow, it reaches into the well screen, hits the sump. Then another one was, you know, what if you use existing down gradient water supply wells? There are some in the area, but that gets into the same issue that we talked about before, and that's once you start finding things in there, you have a limited ability to fix it. Now, when you take those issues and you look at ADEQ's concern, is you certainly don't want something that's 100% modeled. The MEC items are dispersed. Even though there's a couple thousand items out there, those couple thousand items are spread over, you know, 600, 700 acres. So they want something with a capture zone. In addition, in some of these things that you're installing, just like we were talking about, you're not going to go into an area that's got a heavy potential for MEC and drill a hole right through the middle of it. You'll have to do some clearance and removal. Well, those are the waste items that you're supposed to be monitoring for them to come up, to be released. So if you're moving them, you know, it's kind of defeating the purpose. So you're looking for a capture zone. The solution has to have some expandability. It's a large site. You want to be able to add additional monitoring locations to the site fairly economically as you move forward, because you may need to expand what you're monitoring based on the data, or maybe you're seeing in certain areas a little bit of an uptick of MC and you want to get a few more monitoring locations in that area so that you can localize that area so that you can look at, you know, potential corrective actions. The solution had to be repeatable. You had to be able to establish a baseline condition, which is the current site conditions, and then you have to be able to repeat that result to compare it against what could have happened if you had the release. And because you're still looking at something that's a variable from what's typically asked for, they still wanted to see that source receptor monitoring. So those offsite wells, you know, even though they've been monitored some in the past, they still wanted that to be monitored. So you just have that safety net. So the agreed upon alternative was a vado zone well. A vado zone well is drilled through the 16 to 30 feet of unconsolidated material. It's screened across the bedrock interface, maybe a foot into the bedrock with the screen, and then you have a sump on the end of it. And you want to locate those to maximize the probability of capturing infiltration. So you want to look at low-lying areas, you want to look at flow areas, but you want to also make sure that those areas contain the highest level of suspected MEC items or MC, but MC was largely evaluated but still is in the equation. So you want to find the areas where it had the most operational that would be the most telling to you, you know, as to what you are finding. Now, the reason this all becomes important is if you kind of look at this map, this little blue circle right here, that's our post-closure area. That's going to be our permitted area. This darker circle around here, that's what the OBOD area started at. This is the area that we had to investigate, and through clearance and investigation, we were able to shrink it down to this area. the local wells, you can see them kind of out to this distance. This is a 5-mile red ring. There's a few in here. And groundwater is flowing. The regional groundwater table is believed to be flowing, you know, in that northeast direction. So you're looking at a site that is technically complicated. It's not just that it's a MEC item, it is a technically complicated site. And you want something that meets the requirements of RCRA and you're not establishing a precedent. That would be a term that we use, is you don't want to establish precedents for people to come in and think they have an excuse to do nothing. You know, so we looked at it from a standpoint of how can we capture the data, you know, that's needed. So when we proposed them, we had a rationale table, you know, that said, okay, we want to go in low-lying areas, we want to go in areas that would potentially contain ponded water, and you can kind of tell by the picture, we succeeded. You know, some of these wells, you had to walk through water to get to. We did install 20 of them. Like Kim talked about before, you know, you have to do it under avoidance, but I had to install, or we had to install 20 wells in areas that were considered, you know, as heavily impacted to serve the purpose of RCRA. And you did that using, you know, downhole geophysics. You had a depth, I think we had a depth of 6 to 10 feet, that once, as long as we weren't in a area where they did the pits, you know, that would allow us to drill beyond that, but it was done slowly. Sometimes some of the items, you know, might have to be cleared to get you a work aid, but for the most part, I'm pretty sure this one was all done under avoidance and done successfully. It was done in Flagstaff, same mold. This is the weather in Arizona. You think it's all sunny, but in Flagstaff, we started. It looked like it did on the left. When we finished, it looked like it did on the right. I can't tell you why. This was one of those jobs that Thanksgiving was always the end date. No matter when we started, we were in the field until Thanksgiving, and you know, what you see on the right is what we're trying to avoid. I don't know if you can read very much on this well screen, but the well you can kind of see on the right, you see the bedrock, a little bit of a sump to it, it's kind of fractured, and then you got a little bit of unconsolidated material. The wells were anywhere from 6 to 7 feet to 30 feet deep. We tried to have as much of a seal on them as we could, but in some cases you were just kind of left with dealing with the area that you could. When they're first put in, you weren't sure what you were going to get, and you weren't sure how you were going to know when to monitor them. So one of the things that was looked at is, you know, after we had our first period of monitoring and we saw some data, we said, well, maybe we should put in a telemetry system in a couple of the wells. Select three, we have transducers in them. We'll be able to record this data, and it'll tell us a good time to sample, because you can't just walk out there. They're all within an area that requires UXO escort. So we picked some areas that required, that we thought would be good for telemetry. And on the left, you kind of see our first attempt at an installation. And there's the box, and these were the cords. And what we found is that there are a lot of elk in this area, and these black cords are like licorice. We installed the well, I think this one was done on Thursday. By Monday, we'd lost contact with it, came back in to the one on the right, and you realize, okay, you just can't give them the opportunity. So we had some concerns when you're going in that you're looking at. It's like, what's the amount and duration of water moving through the soil? What's unknown? Is there going to be enough? Is it going to be a flowing environment or a seeping environment? It's still a remote area, hence the telemetry. You can't just keep popping out there and looking, because you need escort each time. We suspected there would be two infiltration events, and that would be during a spring snowmelt and then a summer monsoon season. That's the time you get appreciable rain. And we didn't know if the results would be repeatable. You know, will you get water in the same wells? If you detect anything, will you get a similar detection the next time, kind of as a baseline? Well, a hydrograph showed that it really worked, that you had a system where the water came in and it flowed through. You know, it flowed through at different rates. You can see the different lines moving up and down. During that one period, during our best period, we had 17 out of the 20 wells, you know, gain enough water to sample. We sampled for 2 years. The first sampling was 11 wells. The second one was 3, and during the monsoon, and one of those 3 was pretty, yeah, I would call it seepage water. It was never really flowing. It just kind of seeped in. Then during the next spring melt, there was good snow, and we had a good flow through there. Each well, like I said, has a transducer, and only a couple have the telemetry, so we have the data, you know, from all the wells. But, you know, one thing you can kind of see in here, and it was important, is not all of them reacted the same. Some of them got water quickly. Some of them were a little bit slower, and then you have the steady release. A couple lines you can kind of see where there was either a bailing where we went and took the water out. What we got is we got a proof of concept. We got water in the wells. Not all the wells all the time. We got 3 to 17 wells to sample. What we found, and you kind of have a mixed feeling about this, is, you know, the site was largely clean based on the soil investigation, but we still found RDX in some of the wells, and we found perchlorate in some of the wells, and those results ended up being repeatable. Now, in a way, you're not happy to see them, but it also tells you that it worked, that the system was, you know, pulling in water over an area, and that the results were repeatable. It certainly came across that the site was, the monitoring was robust enough. You know, we could capture water even in very low flow, but only in a few places, or low precipitation. And in higher precipitation, you know, we got a lot more of it. So the system worked, and the site worked, and, you know, so it was able to meet the requirements of RCRA without having to go through the letter of RCRA. So, you know, kind of the takeaways through this is the RCRA closure, post-closure, and MR sites can be addressed to both the regulatory requirements and the site-specific changes. You know, these MR sites are not the same as chemical sites. The term that keeps coming up when you're talking about these sites with regulators is it's like a landfill. Well, when you look at the requirements of the landfill, a lot of them don't apply. Some of them do. So, you know, it's not really a landfill. It's a little unique. CERCLA closure at an MR site can satisfy a RCRA. You just have to make sure you have them, you know, engaged so that it's not that these things are getting dumped on them at the end. That goes into, you want to engage the stakeholders early. You want to have the strategy. You want to understand what people's expectations are and work with them to achieve a common goal. This one's important because you get into this a lot. A site complexity does not negate the need to comply with the regulatory requirement. It may adjust how you're going to comply with it, but it doesn't allow you to do nothing. For those of you who have read through a technical infeasibility waiver, they're not easy to get. You do a lot of work to show technical infeasibility because you have to look at it from a lot of different ways. You know, look for other means to meet the intent. Understand what their concerns were. A big moment on this was when we realized from the regulators that they wanted a capture. They wanted something that captured a larger area than just its, you know, immediate surroundings, because they did understand how the waste was displayed over the site. And then lastly, you want to do it in a collaborative method. You certainly want to use the TPP process and, you know, say what you're going to do up front. And if you have to make changes, get them involved early on it. But very little of what we report to them, and I would say virtually nothing of what we reported or any changes we made were any surprises, because we had talked through, you know, all the processes. And then, you know, that's the end. It's up for questions. And, you know, one last observation. We start every presentation with the 3 R's, and we end every presentation with something most definitely not 3R related, but we all love to see the explosions.
Excellent. Very good, Mike. And just as a note, you know, I guess the grass is always greener on the other side, because I always feel like I bludgeon my way through PowerPoint, And I usually have PowerPoint envy when I see the presentations from private industry. So, no, that was really, really great. We had a question that came in that it's not really specific to Mike's presentation, but I'll go ahead and throw it out there anyway. And I mean, Mike, you're certainly welcome to tackle this if you want, but I'll probably throw it over to Ed. Bullets that are used for their intended purpose on a shooting range and sent for recycling are not classified as solid waste and hence not a RCRA hazardous waste. Are the rubber targets containing the lead shot also exempt from classification as a hazardous waste? If so, please mention a reference. Ed, you want to give us your take on that?
Sure. Well, I think that, you know, we're all pretty clear with the scrap metal exclusion, you know, in 261.4. I don't think there is anything similar to that with regard to rubber targets or, you know, impact types of materials. So technically it would meet the definition of debris, and then you'd have to make a determination as to whether that debris was a hazardous waste debris. Now, depending on how heavily loaded the rubber targets are, you might be able to argue that there's still some economic value to the metal that's trapped in them, and you're going to reclaim or recycle that metal, and the rubber is just along for the ride. That would be something that I would want to get clear guidance from my regulator on within my specific state before I made that determination.
Okay, very good. Mike, we did a couple of questions that did pop up that are specific to your presentation. The first one is, did you ultimately answer the question on whether the aquifer was being affected?
No, there's another phase to this, which will make for another nice conversation. When we got the Vadozone data, when we started to get detections in there, you know that those compounds are going somewhere. And we're currently working with ADEQ to go through a simple transport model where you're taking the water and the concentrations that you're seeing in the Vadozone, and you are doing a simple model to the regional water table at a compliance point. The difference between that approach and the one I, you know, negated early on is we're actually using real data and taking it through to the end, and we're not making assumptions from the start. So we think we've answered, well, we probably answered the question internally. We just have to work with our regulator, and we all agree that we've answered the question.
Okay, very good. So, and I interpret that, Mike, then as that I can pencil you in for a follow-up presentation at a future M2S2 webinar. Is that correct?
Yes, you can, and I will make sure I have those technical people who are doing all the real heavy lifting right here with me.
Very good. Appreciate it. Another question was, so after the RDX was found to be mobile in the soil, what was determined to do at the site? How to remediate the soil? How to capture the water?
Well, the RDX is found is yet to be, whether that's determined to be an issue or whether that's, I don't want to call it de minimis because it's not de minimis, or whether it's background there. We have RDX that we're seeing in the water. We know that it's repeatable. We don't know what the impacts are to the water table. That will kind of backtrack and precipitate whether any corrective actions need to be done. You have to
okay.
take into account that we're taking a very small aliquot of information from those Vadozone wells. They're not real wells, and then you're extrapolating them, you know, to the water table. So,
okay, very good, very good. Well, I'll tell you what, you know, at this point in time, we have on the agenda, you know, opening it up for questions or open discussion for any of our presenters. If anyone has questions for Chris or Mike or Kim, now is your opportunity. And so I'll wait just a couple of minutes to see if there are any questions that come in. While we're waiting on those questions, I was going to, again, mention, give a shout out to our audience. It looks like we had about 170 dedicated souls listening to us today on our webinar. Again, we continue to have really, really good attendance on these webinars. We have a couple more coming up this season. We have one, let's see, what do we have on the dates there? Yeah, the 25th of July on characterization. And then we have one coming up on the 29th of August. That's going to be case studies and lessons learned. So, again, please be sure to tell your network of that opportunity. And, again, thank you very much for the 170 folks that tuned in today. I'm not seeing any other questions that have popped up. Oh, wait a second. One may have just shown up. What are the regulatory requirements for BIPs conducted during the SSI phase? SSI? Not sure I quite follow that. Again, I may be hitting you cold with this, Ed, but I'm going to see if Ed or anybody else wants to tackle that.
In terms of regulatory requirements, and I'm assuming when we have the double S that we're talking the site investigation phase, policy-wise, I'm going to defer to Duane, but that's typically not a phase in which we are actively looking to, to actively manage, MEC types of items. And I think there's some policy procedures in place where there might be a handoff in that regard to the local sheriff and or EOD. If we move forward to the remedial investigation phase, then I think we try to address, although ARARs aren't really in place at that point, I think we try to meet any substantive requirements that we can under something like subpart X. But I believe in terms of the CORE's safety programs and policies, for all intents and purposes, those work plans are really addressing, those subpart X components as well as protection of the environment when we're doing that.
Yeah, Duane, this is Chris Evans. I think, the first part of the answer is depends on, what is the regulatory framework you're working under. If you're working under CERCLA, our position right now is there are no regulatory requirements. We would address the EOXO items or BIP them under the provisions of the ESP or the ESS for that site that's been, routed and approved through our Department of Defense Explosive Safety Board, and that would be the extent of it under CERCLA. Under RCRA, as you heard from Kim's presentation, depending on what the permit requirements are, you may have to apply for emergency permits when you're on that RCRA facility.
Very good. All right, well, I don't see any other questions that have popped up from the audience, and so I'm going to turn it over to Gene here in just a second for our conclusion. Again, I wanted to thank the audience. I very much wanted to thank our presenters today. A lot of work goes into putting this together and presenting it. So a big shout out there to Chris Evans, Kim Meacham, and Mike Heitman. We're very, very grateful for your efforts on this. And again, please register for the upcoming sessions and let everyone know about this opportunity. I don't believe I have anything else. And so with that, Gene, I think I will turn it over to you to wrap us up.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much, Duane. I also want to echo thanks again to the nearly 170 individuals and all of our speakers and other co-hosts that were able to join us for today's seminar. If you'd like to learn more about what we offer on the Cleanup Information Network, or you'd like to browse the previously recorded seminars that have been hosted as part of the M2S2 seminar series, I'd encourage you to visit us at the Clean Information Network website at cluin.org. You'll also find us on popular professional and social networking sites like LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. For those of you that would like to download an electronic copy of the seminar slides, they are available as PDF files from the seminar homepage. There's a direct hyperlink. It's called Additional Resources. You'll also find it under the related URLs pod to the right seminar for today's event. We do read each and every one of those responses, and I know I, as well as the organizers, are really counting on your feedback to help improve future deliveries. So if you can, again, that hyperlink is available under seminar feedback. It's on the seminar homepage. It's active from this point forward. If you're not sitting at a computer with internet access right now or don't have time, you can refer back to that feedback form at a later date. And if you're one of the individuals watching the recorded version of today's seminar, you too can still submit feedback based on the replay of the archived session. Those links will remain active. If you join the line with multiple individuals and sort of shared your participation stream, each person can submit their own feedback form. Once you fill it out, there'll be a link that will appear to let another person fill out their own form. And for those of you that ask about CEUs or PDHs to earn credit for attending the sessions, we don't distribute certificates or official credits through CLUIN. However, if you save the registration email, you have copies of the presentation materials, and you fill out the feedback form, there is a box that you can check, circled in red here on this picture, that will send a confirmation message to you via email so that you can at least verify you submitted feedback after the live delivery. And very often, if you take all of that information together, your training officer or accrediting institution will give you credit for participating in our seminars. Again, today's session was recorded, and it takes us approximately 1 to 2 weeks to post those archives. You will automatically receive an email as soon as that free archive is available to replay, and we encourage you to share it with anyone that you think will find it to be a valuable use of their time. Thanks again so very much for joining us today. This will be the formal conclusion for today's CLUIN seminar.